I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the impact of urban heating. We'll discuss both what can be done about it, what is being done about it, and who is doing it. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli, IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences, Jim Poyser, Executive Director of Earth Charter Indiana, and Andrea Webster with the Environmental Resilience Institute. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the impact of urban heating. We're going to talk about what it is, what can be done about it, what is being done about it, and who is doing the things that are being done about it. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli. He is IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences, Jim Poyser, the Executive Director of Earth Charter Indiana, and joining us by phone is Andrea Webster with the Environmental Resilience Institute. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. So I want to talk because I always think it's good to have a baseline for a discussion. There are going to be people. And I'll start with Gabriel on this. Can we talk a little bit about what we mean by urban heating?
Sure. In a nutshell, cities are about 5 degrees warmer than their surrounding countrysides. And that's largely because there's so much what we call gray and black infrastructure in cities. So there's buildings, there's streets, there's parking lots. They absorb a tremendous amount of solar radiation, sunlight, and heat up at the ground level. So you can really feel that, in fact. And the problem with urban heat is it's not only hotter during the day, but it remains significantly hotter all through the night as that heat from that gray infrastructure continues to radiate out into the air.
And in a nutshell, I'll go with Jim, but I'd also like to hear Andrea's thoughts on this. Why is this a problem?
Well, we know that increased heat trends that we're seeing and seeing on into the future are not good for human health, and they're not good for all sorts of creatures that are going to have difficulty sustaining their current metabolism, their current system at the rate that we're going.
Andrea, I'll refine the question just a little bit. In what ways are they not good for health?
Extreme heat can cause heat stress, heat exhaustion, heat stroke, or even heat-related mortality. And then additionally, as heat increases, air pollution increases, which can aggravate things like chronic pulmonary disease, lung cancer, respiratory diseases, and allergies and asthma, which we see even in our children.
And I'll stay with you, Andrea. This isn't a problem, obviously, that is specific to Indianapolis. All cities deal with it at some level, correct?
That is true, yes. There was a study released by the Urban Climate Lab of Georgia Tech in 2012, and it showed how urban heat is increasing by decade and is predicted to increase over the coming decades. And it showed that Louisville, Kentucky, so just south of the Indiana border, has the most rapidly growing urban heat island in the country. And Indianapolis fell sixth on that list. So it's a problem around the country, and it's a problem here in Indiana.
So when we say sixth, I just want to make sure everybody understands. We mean it is a big problem here. We are number six on the bad list, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And in that sense, probably ought to ask, what are the cities, and I'll throw this to Jim, Andrea, or Gabriel, whichever one of you, are there cities that are coping with this more effectively than others, and what are they doing?
I'm a big fan of what Louisville has done to cope with that number one ranking on the bad list, as you put it, John. And I happen to know that Andrea on the phone here has had some on-the-ground experience with that program. Andrea?
Sure. Well, so there are plenty of ways to start to respond to urban heat. The first thing that Louisville did was to conduct a study to see how urban heat is impacting its neighborhoods and its residents. The most important thing to note is that the temperature isn't just one temperature inside of a city. It's going to vary throughout the city, and it's going to change by the urban morphology of the city or how the city is made up and how many buildings are around or how many trees are around. And so when you start to look at what is the temperature compared to the residents in that surrounding area, then you can start to say, okay, where are the areas do we need to focus in on? So maybe it's in and around our elementary schools or where a lot of young people live or where a lot of our older residents are living. And so the study that Louisville conducted in partnership with Georgia Tech's Urban Climate Lab really looked at what are the health vulnerabilities across the city. So they looked at temperatures at 2 meters above ground. They modeled that across the city, which is where humans live and reside, you know, as opposed to measuring surface temperature. And so they looked at that, and they compared that to the three main strategies you use to reduce urban heat. So that would be those three strategies are installing cool infrastructure, so cool roofs, white roofs, cool coatings on asphalt and concrete. The second one being increasing the number of trees or green vegetation that you have throughout a city. And the third one is just reducing the waste heat that's coming from buildings and from vehicles.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the impact of urban heating today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So let's talk a little bit, because I want to make sure people understand the factors other than location. You know, that one might presume, obviously, that it's going to be warmer in New Orleans than, say, Toronto. What factors, you know, move cities onto the bad list, the things that that the cities can actually control? Because presumably, you know, there's no way to avoid having sunlight come down or anything like that, the forces that heat. Gabriel, I'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you that, first of all, that urban heat island and then the health implications, it's not a static factor. In fact, Jim indicated that with climate change, we're seeing a significant increase in the number of extremely hot days and particularly number of extremely hot nights. So Indianapolis, for example, is a city already experiences only about 4 days or so of temperatures in excess of 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that's considered sort of a one of these health limits. By the 2020s, that number is going to be 2 weeks, so 14 days. The 2050s, it's going to be a month. Compound that with what I indicated earlier, the higher humidity and high nighttime temperatures, is you get real stress on elderly and children. So I think in terms of the way cities have to adjust to this in the future is to know that this is going to happen and to proactively develop strategies to help the most vulnerable populations, children, the elderly, particularly elderly, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about this a little bit later on, and also be supportive of efforts, like Andrea pointed out, to make urban forests, and not do it randomly, but do it very specifically in areas that maybe have the highest number of people who might be vulnerable.
Jim, what are the things, though, that that we as a community are doing that add to this problem, the things that that put us number six on the bad list?
Yeah. First of all, John, I want to say I'm a longtime listener, first-time guest.
Okay.
I have communicated with the show via email, but there are lots of ways to ask questions. This is what I do. I am not a scientist or an expert. I rely on people like Andrea and Gabe. Literally, Gabe has come to our camps for kids And in that camp that we do with the Peace Learning Center every summer, we were able to build a community of kids that decided they wanted to approach the city of Indianapolis with what we call a climate recovery resolution. This started around in 2016, and these kids worked on the science. They practiced how to testify before the city council. Mm-hmm. We picked up some great city county council support, Zach Adamson, Jared Evans, and others. And we eventually, in February of 2017, saw the passage of a climate recovery resolution at the city county council level that was voted in by Mayor Hogsett. And we'll get into the weeds on that resolution perhaps some other time. But one of the demands of that resolution was for the city of Indianapolis to develop a climate action plan to deal with these very issues we're talking about today. Not one city in Indiana at the time had a climate action plan, and really to this day, no city really does, but they are starting to work on it. But I'm proud to say that Indianapolis has actually taken this passage of the resolution, and I mean their 9, 10, 11-year-old kids that were talking before the city council demanding action because their future is imperiled, not only by urban heat, but the pests and the disease and all the other issues they're going to have to deal with as adults. Anyway, Indianapolis is now involved in a climate resiliency planning process called Thrive Indianapolis. And you can go to thriveindianapolis.com. It's a 12-month process. They're about half the way through. And everyday people like myself are involved in that process. Mm-hmm. Kids are involved. And essentially what we're doing is we're giving the city input on the kind of city that we can envision that's sustainable. Mm-hmm. One of the aspects of that, of course, is how do we fight this urban heat effect that we're focusing on today?
Andrea, again, what are the things that, I mean, obviously we cannot control the sun, but at the ground level here, what are the things as a community that we are doing that that sort of exacerbate its negative effects?
Sure. Well, I think, so one of the things you know is that most cities and towns across the country and across Indiana and even in Indianapolis, have plans in place for when a winter storm hits. But cities are slowly starting to start putting plans in place and developing plans for when a heat wave comes through. And so that's one of the things that Indianapolis is working on through their mitigation plan. Their multi-hazard mitigation plan. So that's one of the things. That's specifically to protect heat. Protect the residents from heat and heat waves, as Gabe was saying. But some of the things that can be done, I mean, any tree planting efforts. So trees are very good at providing shade, and they block 70 to 90% of solar radiation in the summer, and even 20 to 90% in the winter. So those are good tools. Some places are considering putting on cool coating on their parking lots. So that's one thing we can do. One of the more challenging things that we, I guess, maybe I'll start with the easiest thing. So any time a company or a school has a no idling policy, that's going to reduce the amount of waste heat coming from a vehicle. So anytime your car is running for 10 seconds or more, turn it off, roll down your windows, and you'll save some gas and some money in addition to reducing the heat that you're putting out of your vehicle. And then additionally, energy efficiency projects within buildings. So there's plenty of buildings across and companies and even the local government is implementing strategies to make their buildings more efficient.
Gabriel,
use less energy.
Gabriel, maybe another way to approach this is what are the forces that are leading to the increases here? I mean, this is a problem that seems to be growing in force, even though we're aware of it and apparently some steps are being taken. But if we're saying by the 2020s, we're going to be seeing 2 weeks, and then by 2050, a month of 95, that's a pretty alarming upward tick.
That's right. And the forces are a combination of two. One is a more global force, and that's climate change driven by human release largely of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, which takes a more of a global effort. But in the local sense, it comes down to the fact that gray infrastructure, things we build and see, have a lot more value than green infrastructure. And we haven't adequately used that green infrastructure as an urban planning tool to offset this urban heat island. I think we're going to see that it's going to have to be a very important part of the mix in the future for Indianapolis and other cities around the country.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the impact of urban heating today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli. He is IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences, Jim Poyser, who is Executive Director of Earth Charter Indiana, and Andrea Webster, who is with the Environmental Resilience Institute. When we come back, we're going to start talking about some things that we can do to combat this problem and some of the innovative efforts that are being made here in Indianapolis. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the impact of urban heating here in Indianapolis and central Indiana. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli. He is IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences, Jim Poyser, who is Executive Director of Earth Charter Indiana, and Andrea Webster, who is with the Environmental Resilience Institute. If you want to join the conversation, you can do that in several ways. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Elizabeth has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Elizabeth writes, "Maintaining and increasing our tree canopy in Indianapolis is critical for keeping infrastructure and the entire city cooler. I am bearing witness, though, to our city who talks the talk about sustainability and tree preservation. However, they keep approving developers' plans to remove acres and acres of mature trees, and even the city parks are putting forward plans to remove trees in Canal Park and replace them with a hardscape playground. And then Broad Ripple Park is a $65 million plan to remove mature trees and add significant hard surfaces. It's really discouraging for people who get it and are actively advocating for tree preservation in the city. Can you please comment on that?" Jim, I would imagine you're going to want a piece of that one.
Well, what a struggle. Yeah. What a struggle. We're on a path as a community and as a planet to grow population and build things, and everybody wants what they want to have in this culture. And so I am heartbroken to see trees be cut down everywhere I go. I really feel what Elizabeth is saying. I think the only thing I can offer at this point is to say that in my experience, the city is listening, perhaps not on that specific issue that you mentioned, but in the Thrive Indianapolis process, we are being invited to have input on this process. The climate resiliency planning product that the city will propose in early 2019, as I understand it, will have to have a tree canopy and a preservation aspect to it, or we're not really preparing for climate change. So I would say we do have the opportunity. We have an opening right now on a larger level to participate in that process. And honestly, on a local level, when you see a development happening, there have been strategies by the Indiana Forest Alliance, for example, in a couple of spots. Of course, Crown Hill turned out to be a victory, other places not so, where people just stand up and they say, don't build that here. The trees are important. They bring us life. They bring diversity.
Andrea, how much of this is, though, also that, and I can't imagine Indianapolis is alone in this, that, you know, we think of environmental protection at some level in one silo and development in another silo, when in fact, you know, the plans have to be, you know, mutual or you know, at some level combined.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, these are definitely tough issues, especially from a city government's perspective. So the first thing that a city government can do is educate its own staff about urban heat and the dangers that come from urban heat, as well as the strategies to try to prevent the heat illnesses that we see. So so educating parks departments as well as public works staff can be really, really useful, in addition to educating the zoning commissions and the planning commissions as they're reviewing some of the development proposals. The next step is to try to develop policies or ordinances that can position a city to be better, to be more responsive to urban heat. So things like tree protection ordinances to try to protect trees from being cut down. And of course, the city only has jurisdiction over trees on public land, which is typically a very small percentage of what is present in a city like Indianapolis, which is very large. And so so that's one strategy. Another strategy could be looking at cool roof ordinances. So that would entail requiring any new construction or any renovation to require those buildings to install roofs that are more reflective rather than absorbing heat.
We are talking about the impact of urban heating today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Jennifer has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi. I was just listening to your program, and it had occurred to me, I remember in the 70s we had a big campaign to get people to turn their heat down during the winter, and I find everywhere I go today is over air conditioned, and I wonder why we haven't focused on trying to get people to conserve energy during the warmer months, particularly as it gets warmer.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. I'll throw that one first to Gabriel.
Well, conservation seems to have become a bad word. It certainly was big in the 70s and 80s, but we seem to, that's definitely what we consider low-hanging fruit. It's clear that that buildings are cooled, particularly in the summer, to satisfy the lowest common denominator, which is probably the least active person in the building. It's usually, I find them, frankly, uncomfortable for most everybody else. So certainly there's efforts by large organizations to change the set points. I know IUPUI has done that systematically. The centralized set points for some of these big buildings where an individual doesn't have the capacity to change a thermostat individually. But I think you're exactly right. We're still not getting it in terms of our use of energy and our heating of our own environments.
I think one problem we have is that our IPL, which is our electricity provider, actually reduces the amount of cost per kilowatt the more you use. Am I correct in that? I mean, it just what we need to do is incentivize these energy efficiency
models. Consumption.
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking about urban heating here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Nicholas has done and reach out to us via Facebook. You can find us at No Limits WFYI. Nicholas writes, are there any indications of Indianapolis or other cities making plans for the future primarily through environmental thinking and economics secondarily, considering how environmental extremes impact economics and health?
Jim. Well, the Office of Sustainability here in Indianapolis is headed up by Katie Robinson, and she has other colleagues in that department. It's closely tied to the Department of Public Works. These are great people doing great work. What I would like to see is a sustainability office in Indianapolis and in all large cities where all the decisions are run through sustainability, right? This is the lens by which we have to look at for the survival of our children and grandchildren. And I think that the right pieces are in place for Indianapolis to grapple with sustainability with a more focused effort.
Andrea, is that argument, though, about, pitting, in effect, environmental responsibility against economic development a false choice? It seems to me that there could be massive sums of money to be made from converting these. Yeah,
it is. In fact, we recently met with the mayor of Carmel, Indiana, and he told us about a strategy in which reducing urban sprawl, which can actually increase a city's revenue stream. And so there are plenty of ways in which, making environmentally friendly choices is going to save you money. energy efficiency and conservation, of course, being the gold star, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, in that category.
We're talking about the impact of urban heating here on No Limits. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for taking the call.
Certainly.
My question is kind of a good segue from the point that was just made by one of the guests there, is that the money savings tends to always be in the longer term. And they're, for green building, especially at the residential level, there's always kind of an upfront bite, right, as far as the investment. My question is, what's being done to either create programs or create more awareness for grants, financing options, government assistance for those of us that want to use more green building methods in our homes?
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Scott. So, Andrea, in looking at other places around the country, what are some communities that are doing a great job of incentivizing on the front end? Because Scott's right. Most of the sales pitch for this is, yes, you'll recoup your costs in 5 or 10 years or whatever. But for a lot of people, they're thinking, I may not even be living in this residence at that point, or we may not be working out of here or anything like that. How do we get them to do the right thing up front?
Sure. Well, there is a policy option that's called Property Assessed Clean Energy. And so what that is it's an alternative financing mechanism for commercial buildings or residential buildings, residential homes, to finance energy efficiency, renewable energy, or energy efficiency up front. So how it works is that the policy allows you to take out a loan for your energy efficiency, renewable energy, energy conservation project. And from there, the repayment is filtered through your property taxes. And so you work with a company to design a project that will ultimately save you money. So even if your property tax payment is increasing as a result of this project, then your payments are still going to be less than what your utility bill payments would have been otherwise. And the other thing that's great about this type of policy is that you can it's tied to your the property assessment. So that means that when you to the property title or deed. So when you sell the home or you sell the commercial property, that loan is transferred to the new property owner. So it's one mechanism to eliminate that barrier where folks say, I'm only going to be in this home or in this building for 5 years and I'm not going to see a payback before then. So they can start receiving those, energy paybacks, return on investment right away. But, again, that's a policy that would need to be passed through the Indiana state legislature before it could be implemented by cities across the state.
Jim.
Yeah, I wonder. Certainly, Scott is correct. And when you talk about renewable energy, for example, there's an upfront investment that then has that payback. The first thought that occurs to me about that is, what's the cost if we don't do this, right? Mm-hmm. The cost is catastrophic climate change. But I want to challenge the assumption that it is cheaper to build a non-sustainable building in terms of building materials, mm-hmm. The LEED certification. I've actually read some interesting studies, probably through the USGBC, mm-hmm. which is very focused on climate change and building sustainable and living buildings, that it is actually about on par in at least some of the major building material aspect of constructing a building. So, Scott, I challenge you and I challenge myself to actually push back on that assumption that it is cheaper. You might be right a good deal of the time, but I think we're finding that even the building of buildings in a way that is sustainable is actually on par with the old ways. I think we have a lot of the old assumptions and old thinking going on right now that we have to challenge ourselves so we can have a livable city for our kids and grandkids.
Gotten an email from a listener, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. This listener writes, plant a tree, huh? My best friend and his mom would plant a tree every Arbor Day and Earth Day at US 31 and Epler on the south side. It was a beautiful, thick patch of urban trees. That was then bulldozed to build a Walgreens. Couldn't we put an emphasis on reutilizing already existing empty concrete? Gabriel, is that a different way is to say, okay, to approach this problem before you can build something new in a green space, you've got to show us that there's absolutely nothing that would suit your needs in a previously developed spot.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is what comes back to my earlier point of not adequately valuing green space, green infrastructure along with gray infrastructure. In this case, there are a lot of capacities for communities to proactively do that, to make sure that new developments pass that litmus test of have they considered the ability to repurpose the gray infrastructure so that that doesn't happen. And in fact, there are plenty. I could list the array of studies that show the value of older tree stocks and older forest stocks for local health in terms of air quality and in terms of local temperature. And I guarantee you when that stock is, that forest stand is bulldozed, none of that value is recouped. So basically it's a loss for everybody.
We are talking about the impact of urban heating on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Bruce has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Bruce, you're on the air.
Thank you, John.
Certainly.
I wondered if there is a program for the businesses downtown. IPL offers a program where you can be on green energy. You can buy 25, 50, or 100%. My bill monthly is like on the budget plan is $189, and only $1.95 of that extra is for me to be 100% on green energy, and I buy offsets so that I get all of my energy from wind and solar. Are any of the buildings downtown offered that, or does any of the city do that?
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Jim, do you have an answer?
Bruce, that's great. I'm on the green power option myself. I find that it costs very little to do so. It's kind of a complex credit swapping scheme, far beyond my pay grade to understand how that's done. But I think it's a really good thing to do. And if you go to IPL's site and search out the green power option, every resident can do it. I think there is a business building program as part of that. I'm not sure you can go 100% on that, but I haven't fully studied that because I don't have a business.
Gabriel, you look like you wanted to say something.
Yeah. For example, larger organizations like IUPUI, which is one of the largest energy consumers in the city of Indianapolis, they are also part of the Green Power Plan. So they provide it's a different percentage that's allowable. Yet there's capacity for organizations to do that. Of course, downtown has a more complex energy supplier because they have a steam supply system as well. So it's a little bit different from a normal residential property. I'm also on a 100% green power plan and find it makes no monthly difference whatsoever to my bill.
I read this great metaphor just yesterday, and they said, okay, so your house is flooding because you left the faucet on. So you can just get a whole bunch of friends and a whole bunch of buckets and just keep, you know, bailing out your house, or you can go to the faucet. And for each one of us, there's a faucet. If you're a person that works in an office and it's too darn cold, go to the person who can control that thermostat. If that thermostat is controlled by the big corporation that owns your company, go to that corporation. And, of course, we can all in our individual lives go to that faucet and slow down that faucet, in some cases even turn it off. Because right now, mostly what we're doing is just bailing out the externalities of that faucet running.
Is it, if I could ask, Gabriel, since you seem to have some knowledge of what the expense or how IUPUI does it, what is the difference and how much of their power then comes from green sources?
I believe there's a cap that IPL provides for corporate purchasers of power. I don't know exactly. I'd heard somewhere it's 25%. IUPUI itself is also developing and working to implement a sustainability plan that will significantly reduce our carbon dependency as a campus. You know, our campus is a combined academic campus plus hospital system. So obviously you can't turn off the plug on things. But nevertheless, I think there's hope for a lot of Indianapolis area organizations.
We are talking about urban heating today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli, he is IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences, Jim Poyser, Executive Director of Earth Charter Indiana, and Andrea Webster with the Environmental Resilience Institute. We're going to continue this discussion in just a little bit. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the impact of urban heating. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli, IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences, Jim Poyser, Executive Director of Earth Charter Indiana, and Andrea Webster with the Environmental Resilience Institute. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Richard has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you. So, up until about, 5 years ago, the city had a no-idling program, which now has died mainly because the City Air Pollution Control Board no longer exists. Mayor Ballard did not support it. Mayor Hogsett has killed it, even though the law is still on the books. And at one time in the downtown area and you saw no idling signs, especially where places the trucks stop. And the worst part is that you see long lines of cars sitting idling at suburban schools in the wintertime and in the summertime, emitting toxic gases, actually. Auto exhaust is something you don't want to breathe. And there's really nothing being done on an organized level anymore to approach this problem of idling. Now, it certainly is not as significant as heating from solar sources during the summer, but every little bit counts, and it really has a twofold advantage of, one, reducing heat emissions and also reducing hazardous air emissions.
Thanks very much for the call, Richard. We'll see if we can get a response for you.
Wow, another great call. Richard, you've really hit my pet peeve. Idling cars is one of the most frustrating things to me, as people are sitting there and they're putting carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And it just seems like the easiest thing for us to solve. I'm a year-round bicycle commuter, and every stoplight I sit and I watch people driving by themselves back and forth, usually to a very near proximitous location with each other. But all that aside, my work at Earth Charter Indiana is empowering kids to make a difference. We did a STEM-oriented after-school project at Oak Landon Elementary School in Lawrence. And these kids, they did all the studies, they checked out the impact on asthma, and they came up with a no idling policy at their school that was just beautiful to watch unfold. They dispensed flyers to their parents who were waiting there, letting their cars idle and fouling the air to be breathed by the most precious things in their life. The kids dispensed information, they gave out rewards, and I tell you, they reduced idling at Oak Landon by 80-85% over the course of a school year. I now encourage schools everywhere to try and solve that problem, because if the kids can solve it, the parents are going to come along with it, and then we can spread as much no idling practices throughout the city as is possible.
We've gotten a Facebook comment, a couple of them from a listener named Stella. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Stella writes, great discussion. I'm amazed how many things can be done to make better living in the region. And there is so much space that can be changed. From my experiences in Brazil, there is planning that can be integrated in the process that is very cost effective. And then she says, is there any economic incentive for the citizens being discussed. I'm going to reframe this ever so slightly, Stella, and throw it to Andrea. We have made this conversation very U.S.-centric here, United States-centric so far. Are there places in the world that are combating this problem more effectively than we are, and what are they doing?
Sure. Well, one example is a much larger city, of course, would be Paris. So Paris, and then there's other cities around the world, too, that are actually banning cars in the downtown urban area. So that's eliminating one source of urban heat altogether. And then additionally, there's every single country except for the U.S. is participating in the Paris Accord. And so all the initiatives that are, or the majority of the initiatives that are taking place as a result of that effort are going to reduce urban heat as a sort of secondary effect. So anything that makes buildings more energy efficient, anything that is going to reduce the waste heat coming from vehicles, any tree planting initiatives which sequester and hold carbon that would otherwise be released in the atmosphere, that's going to reduce climate change as well as reduce urban heat in a city. So there's plenty of initiatives around the world that are really helping to combat many issues we're facing today.
Gotten an email from a listener named Mary. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Mary writes, I found a gap actually in my questioning here. Dear No Limits, what does this treatment do during the winter when it's already cool? Thanks. Gabriel, I'm presuming that we're talking about, the cool buildings and a lot of the technology. Are there costs to doing that during the winter, or are they more efficient year-round?
Well, certainly there would be, the net result would be a lower urban heat island in general, including in the winter. But the difference with the winter is that the sun is pretty indirect at this latitude. So some of these mitigating factors are really designed as summer heat mitigators. And, for example, trees don't have leaves on them anyway during the winter. So it's. I don't think if the writer is worried about negative impacts of overly cold cities in the winter, it doesn't look to be a problem for Indianapolis anytime soon.
We have gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Chris. Again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Chris writes, combating urban heating seems to require a progressive mindset, and that's not immediately synonymous with Indianapolis. Does the mayor support the idea of fighting urban heating? Has he ever mentioned it, Jim?
Well, the mayor has spoken out passionately about the issue of climate change. Again, the context in which I'm with Mayor Joe Hogsett, I'm often surrounded by children who are brilliant and who have studied the issue and are respectful in demanding action on it. And he has been nothing but supportive of these Indiana young people.
We are talking about urban heating here on No Limits. Andrew, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm on the Near East Side in what's considered a food desert, and I've been involved with a couple of ladies that have a plan to try to rezone our area into an urban agrihood. And there's been some meetings with Joe Hogsett's office, but it seems like there's a lot of resistance to try to turn the neighborhood around. And like you said, they are very progressive. And I just feel like the plan is wonderful, you know, and it seems like it's just not taking off anywhere from the mayor or anywhere else. And I was just wondering if there was any information that I could get to pass on to these ladies to maybe get this further.
And Andrew, before I throw the question to the panel here, could you describe what an urban agrihood is?
Well,
how you're defining that?
Well, they basically the plan is to, instead of taking the empty lots and turning them into houses, keeping them as green space and either using them for green play or for community gardens or regularly mowing them with sheep instead of regular gas mowers, different initiatives that are all trying to embrace, the ecological diversity of Indianapolis, and also trying to stave off the rising of property taxes for the people that are on limited incomes here. And I'm just wondering if there's somebody else that maybe I can refer them to talk to get this plan furthered into the consciousness of the city and the state.
Well, we'll start with Jim Poyser. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Andrew.
Yes, Andrew, thank you so much. You know, I'm easily found at earthcharterindiana.org. If you go to the contact area, you can send me. I am guessing I know who those two ladies are. I fully support growing food absolutely everywhere we can, in every way we can, on every surface, vertical, horizontal, slanted, you name it. We have to become a food-secure city. And I think that that argument toward the agrihood becomes stronger within the context of a climate resiliency plan. I know I keep promoting that. I do have great trust and faith in our city officials with whom I have had contact on numerous occasions. They get it. They understand what climate change is going to pose for our city. Our water security and our food security are paramount. And it sounds like this is a really wonderful project that could help solve the food desert issue.
Andrea, I'm going to sort of reframe that. Are there places elsewhere in this country or around the world? Because in some ways what Andrew was talking about with these two women is also just reshaping the idea of what we think of as a neighborhood or as a community and what it should be, what it should provide. Are there places that are doing that in ways that are innovative that might be models for us?
Sure. You know, I think there's I can't think of any specific place in particular, but, you know, neighborhoods are definitely a nice way to start to look at a city. And so the more that we can make our neighborhoods be self-sufficient in a sense, so there's plenty of cities around the country that are starting to look at neighborhoods that are very, very walkable. So every neighborhood has a grocery store, has access to fresh food like that, or has other basic necessities. So that way, you know, it reduces the amount of time that we need to be in a car. And then the other interesting thing that many cities are doing and Indianapolis included, is creating bike networks so that folks can be on their bicycles or even walk or jog between those neighborhoods without getting on the road and in a shared roadway with cars.
We've gotten a couple of emails regarding trees from listeners Tess and Jerome. And again, our email address, if you want to join the conversation that way, is nolimits at WFYI.org. They take slightly different slants. Tess argues that, you know, one serious gap in the plan is budgeting for tree maintenance. In addition to tree planting, maintenance of the city's existing mature trees is crucial for making the urban canopy a safe, functional, and beneficial asset. Jerome says that we're also not doing enough to purchase the trees so that we can control whether they continue to exist, and that the cost of purchasing them is a cost-effective way to protect them and to protect ourselves from these kinds of environmental threats. Are we doing enough on that front in this city? And beyond that, are we spending enough to meet these challenges even apart from the tree? I'm going to start with Gabriel on that one.
Yeah, in fact, I think that that's one area where our city has a huge champion, which is Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, which has very creative ways that they partnered with city organizations to plant 10,000 trees. And the interesting thing about KIB is that they're quite aware of the maintenance issue. And so they work really hard at not just planting trees, but planting seeds of growth in our urban youth. My own daughter went through their youth tree team, so she learned the value of trees and tree planting and tree maintenance during a long, hot summer, and how important it is once you get those trees in the ground to protect your investment. In that sense, it paid off in two ways, a greener city and a greener mind for my own daughter.
Jim, are we devoting enough to first preserving trees, but really to dealing with this problem as a community?
Well, I was going to say no, but then Gabe talked about KIB, which, of course, is planting tens of thousands of trees.
Yeah, we got an email from a listener named Pat who asked whether we had mentioned that already.
Yeah, but, you know, there are cities that actually have an arborist on staff. In Indiana, there are cities that have an arborist. I don't think Indianapolis has an arborist. And maybe a climate planning process would actually result in that. But in lieu of that, we do have Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, which regularly converses and partners with the city in planting as many trees as possible.
Andrew, we've just got a couple of minutes left on the program, so I'm going to ask the question from looking at Indianapolis, are we devoting enough of our resources as a community to dealing with this problem? And if not, where should we devote them?
Well, I think for most cities, and including Indianapolis, most cities in the U.S., the answer is going to be no. There's always more that we can do, and I think the status quo for the past several years and past decades has been to build and develop a city, which is healthy in one sense, but I think we need to start thinking more about building and developing a city in partnership with the resources that the earth provides, and we need to protect those resources as much as possible. Because of the ecosystem services they provide.
So what's something the city isn't doing that it should be doing now?
Well, I can't comment on Indianapolis specifically, but, I mean, I think one of the things that all cities can do better, I mean, is definitely plant more trees is always the first step. But then I think working with developers and starting to transition the way the city is laid out the way the city is laid out, because then that has impact on the way the transportation systems work. So it's a much larger scale issue and problem that it's challenging, but the more we start to tackle it, the better.
So, Andrea, we're getting real close on time here, but I'm going to give everybody a crack at this. I'm going to start with you first. In the spirit of Stella's question, what is one thing that an individual could do to combat this problem? One practical step, and you've got about 15 seconds.
If you're a homeowner, you can put on a cool roof, which will save you money, and it has a payback period of around 7 years.
Okay, Jim.
This is going to take policy change at every level. Get involved in your neighborhood and in your city. Show up.
Is there an immediate, though? Is there an immediate something that
As I said, Thrive Indianapolis is that planning process. Go to thriveindianapolis.com and sign up for newsletters and take a survey and show up when they have their events.
Okay. Is there, Gabriel, I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there a step that is beyond sort of the political or the policy thing, one that person can do with his or her own hands or actions, immediate actions?
Certainly one of the big impacts that we haven't really talked about is ozone, and a combination of a lot of local emission sources like vehicles plus hot summer days is going to cause a lot of ozone issues, which is a real killer. And so that's getting rid of your own emission sources, meaning alternative transportation, no mowing and so forth.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Gabriel Filippelli of IUPUI, Jim Poyser of Earth Charter Indiana, and Andrea Webster with the Environmental Resilience Institute. Also like to thank our listeners, as always, for some great, great questions and comments. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.